Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. Goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Peter Campbell Barker, from the rock bands of the 1960s, over to Africa. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And we start this week with, as I said, Peter Campbell Barker. Hi, Peter, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Peter, tell us a bit about your experience in the 1960s. How on earth did you find yourself part of the 60s musical revolution?
Well, I went to a public school, and the guitar was frowned upon in those days, as you may know. Anyway, I brought the guitar to the school, and our music teacher said, "Oh, my dear fellow, you've got a viola. You're playing the viola." Well, of course, it was a guitar, and the fellow was furious, because guitars were just not the thing, you know, in those sort of places. Anyway, I persisted with the guitar and carried on with it after I left school, you know.
How did you meet other members, and what bands were you in?
Well, one of them was my brother. There were various names. I mean, we evolved from one thing to another, you know. The Casuals, I think, was when we started. Then we became the Reprobates, and then we became the Big Idea. There may have been other names as well. I can't quite remember now.
It must have been fun being part of that 60s pop revolution.
Fantastic.
But how much of a revolution really was it?
It really was. I remember Bill Haley coming to this country in the late 50s, and that was really quite something. I mean, it doesn't sound like anything now, but if you'd lived at that time, if you were a young, you know, a teenager at that time, you would have seen the effect it had. It was quite incredible, very liberating. I decided to volunteer for work in Africa. Originally, I wanted to work in a leper colony in Tanzania, or Tanganyika, as I think it was then. And that job, I went to VSO in London, Voluntary Service Overseas, and they didn't give me that job. Someone had pipped me to the post, and so I was sent to Malawi.
Crikey. So what was it like first landing in Malawi, and when was that?
That was in 1967, I think. Of course, I was used to sort of the tropics, because I'd lived in India prior to that. So it wasn't really surprising. Of course, the heat does always get you as soon as you leave the plane, you know, but it was great. I loved it. I loved Africa.
And what were your responsibilities when you arrived in Malawi? Give us a picture of what the place was like.
Eventually, as time went on, I started to get the picture of what was involved with witchcraft.
Well, that sounds a bit scary. I mean, I don't think certainly witchcraft is not just confined to Africa. It's been here
in Britain.
Africa. But tell us, you know, how you experienced it and how it manifested in Africa.
Well, the first time I saw it was, I knew a fellow in one of the villages, and he called himself Jesus. And he called his wife Mary, and he looked like B.A. Baracus, you know, the old B.A. Baracus in the A-team, because he had all these crucifixes round his neck. And he was using the name of Jesus in all sorts of ways in his witchcraft, and it really was disturbing, because I was a nominal Christian in those days, so I had a Christian background. So it was very worrying, and I didn't really understand it. It was confusing to start with.
But how was he actually, what was he doing? What was this chap up to? What were his rituals, that kind
of thing? Well, he was healing, in inverted commas, people using the name of Jesus, basically. And all sorts of, how can I put it, religious claptrap he was coming out with, you know, sort of biblically sounding stuff, which wasn't really biblical at all.
But, I mean, surely spiritual healing is quite valid, and no problem in bringing Jesus' name in. That's not witchcraft, surely.
Well, there are all sorts of things in this world which are under the name of spiritual healing, but I don't believe they are. I mean, psychics are supposed to do it. Psychics can apparently do it, but I don't believe it's their psychic power, and I certainly don't believe it's God.
So what is it then?
It's demonic.
Okay, well, let's go back to this character from the A-Team that you met there. What exactly was he doing? What did you see in practice, and did it work or not?
Oh, yes, it worked. Not always, but sometimes, and that's what was so confusing about it.
Just describe what these rituals that this guy was doing. What was he doing, actually?
Well, he was basically using Mankwala, which is their word for medicine, in the form of powders of one sort or another, plants, parts of animals, and so on and so forth. And they'd spread them over the person in certain ways and shriek. I mean, this wife of his would go around the building, the mud hut, you know, shrieking and coming out with all sorts of odd sounds. And this was supposed to do the trick, and sometimes it did the trick. I'll just give you an example of something that happened which really made me wake up. While I was there, I sent a couple of Africans to America to do studies, so to be trained. Anyway, they came back, and one of them came back with a great big sound system. This was all new, hi-fi, a big hi-fi system, which he bought over there. Of course, that was something new in the 70s. It was almost unheard of in those parts of Africa. And anyway, he installed this in his house, and to cut a long story short, it was stolen. Obviously, the word got around, and he must have been out one night, and somebody got into his house and took the whole lot. Well, of course, he was absolutely devastated, this chap. And so he, after a few days, he said to me, I'm going to such and such a witch doctor who lives about 30 miles away. I said, well, do you mind if I accompany you and see what's going on? No, he said, that's fine. Come along. So went to this place, which was really off the beaten track, in a sort of jungly area. And he went into this hut. I wasn't allowed to go in. I had to stay outside. Anyway, I went in, and he was in there about an hour. There was no artificial light in there, so the hut was very dark, although it was daylight. There weren't any windows. It was just a door one end and the other end. So I didn't really see what was going on and didn't really hear what was going on. Anyway, he came out of this place having coughed up quite a lot of money to give to this fellow. He came out of this place and said, right, this witch doctor chap has told me where my hi-fi system is. Okay, I said, right, so are you going to tell the police or what? He said, yes, that's right. So we got back to where we'd come from, and he told the police, and they raided this particular address, and sure enough, it was there. It was there. And there's a lot of stories I could tell you like that. And well, of course, these chaps, these witch doctors, have got psychic power. Now, of course, the trouble is psychic power isn't psychic. I mean, there's no such thing as psychic power.
Well, many people would say, Peter, that he's got maybe some inside info there.
Yeah, well, it's demons. The demons passing the information on. They're called familiar spirits. And they just pass the information on. That's what happens with mediums. Mediums very often go into a trance, and they're given the information by these demonic forces. And they come out with stuff that they couldn't possibly normally know. It's just not possible.
Now, this whole business of the supernatural, many people just don't believe it. What have you gleaned from your experience in Africa about how it really works?
Well, just that it's demonic. I'm not talking about the Christian aspect of it, but the other aspect of it, which is that it's demonic and it can work. Now, I'm going to come out with something perhaps absolutely crazy, because I know that hypnotism is now part of the NHS. But I tell you that hypnotism is demonic. And that's why it can work. The demons can do something in the person's mind or can make it work. And so because it works very often, they've enlisted hypnotists in the NHS.
I mean, what evidence have you got for that?
Oh, all sorts of things. For instance, there's a lady in our church who went to a hypnotist when she was about 18. It's at Blackpool or one of these places, you know, the big theatre. And people were asked to come up from the audience, and quite a number of people. And this fellow on the stage said, "Now I'm going to hypnotise you all, and I'm going to make you do something, and I'll tell you what I'm going to make you do, and you'll do it before you leave the theatre." Anyway, he told the various people that he was going to do this and that to them, and they did what he said they would do. Now, this lady, I mean, like I say, she was 18 years old at the time. This fellow said to her, "I'm going to make you shout, 'I am Dick Tracy, special agent.'" Now, I don't know if you know Dick Tracy, but Dick Tracy was a character on the radio in the 50s, I think it was, and he was a spy. He was a sort of James Bond character in the early days. Anyway, the show ended, and she didn't shout anything out, and she thought, well, it's not worked. It hasn't worked with me. And as she got towards the auditorium door with all the other people, she found that it was impossible to stop herself shouting something out. And she shouted out, "I am Dick Tracy, special agent." Something just took over her mind and made her do it. And she said it was very powerful.
Well, yes, but what about other things that you saw over in Africa? This is obviously quite interesting, and there's, you know, it's contentious as to what actually hypnotism is really all about. We've actually had on this show a few weeks ago Aldous Huxley talking about the power of hypnotism, but the fact of the matter is that there are only about 80%, well, I say only, the majority of people can be hypnotised. There's a 20% or so that can't, aren't there?
That's right, something like that, yes. But Aldous Huxley died a long time ago. How come you got him on your programme?
Well, because we have a recording of him.
Ah, right, OK.
Anyway, Peter, what else did you see while you were over in Africa?
Well, an experience that stayed with me very vividly was something that really astonished me. I was trying to find out about a tribe, it's a cult, really, and it involves one particular tribe, mainly, called the Niau, N-Y-A-U. And they do all sorts of witchcrafty things, and they've been known to murder people. It's quite astonishing.
Well, most people would not be doing that, Peter. They would be sitting, if there's a cult, probably best to leave them alone.
Yes, I know, yes. Well, I suppose I wanted to live dangerously in those days. I was involved in quite a few dangerous things. Perhaps I liked the adrenaline. I don't know, I can't remember, but my curiosity was enormous to try and find out, to try and get the hang of Africa. And I knew that the Niau were going to do one of their dances and one of their rituals in this forest in the central region of Malawi. This is in the 70s. And so I hid in the forest. I hid, and I'd already been into the forest to see where they did all this. It was around a big baobab tree. There was a baobab tree, which is an enormous sort of fat tree. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. Adansonia digitata. Anyway, they were dancing. They would dance around this thing. I could see all the tracks where they danced. So I hid myself at a suitable distance to try and see what was going on. Anywhere they came, they lit fires and off they went, you know, dancing about and so on. And I noticed above this tree the this smoke from the fires at least I imagine it was from the fires, started to come together. And it formed a disc-like object, it appeared to be. And the hairs on the back of my neck stood up.
So this is above the tree. How big was it?
Above the tree. The tree itself?
No, how big was, yeah, how big was the disc?
It was about 70, 80 feet tall, yes. Yeah. So
and the disc was that. What was how big?
It's difficult to say, but I would say 100 feet wide, possibly, at the most. Something like that.
Okay, and it was sort of just hovering there, was it?
It was just hovering. Yeah, it just sort of slowly manifested itself. And I, as I say, I got the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up. And anyway, I was a born again Christian in those days, so I spoke the words of exorcism at this thing, not out loud, obviously, but I spoke the words. And this thing just disintegrated before my eyes. Very strange. And all their dancing and so on stopped. Obviously, they'd seen it as well.
So what were they up to?
Well, I don't really know, because there was a lot of foliage between me and them. I was trying to see it, but obviously I didn't want them to see me by any means. They were dancing and making noises and so on, and I didn't understand their particular lingo, so I just didn't know. There was an American chap who I knew then, who I was friends with, and he knew something about the Niao, so he was the one who had actually told me where this thing was going to take place and so on. Anyway, then I slowly realized that UFO manifestations might be demonic. And so I looked into it and so on and so forth, and I found that was the case. That aliens are not aliens from other planets at all, but they're a demonic manifestation.
Okay, so
fallen angels have found a way of being able to manifest themselves, which is acceptable, which will fool everyone.
And are you saying that you think that there needs to be these rituals in order to bring this on somehow?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it was to bring them on or whether it just happened when they occurred. I'm not quite sure.
Anyway, what lessons have you got for others, or what do you think has taught you that you'd like to share with others about your experiences?
I would say, more than anything else, could I quote one passage from the Bible, from Deuteronomy 18? Could I do that? Which will explain everything.
Yes, certainly, yeah.
All right. It's Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 and 11. Let no one be found among you who practices divination, that's fortune-telling, or sorcery, or interprets omens, engages in witchcraft, or casts spells, or who is a medium or spiritist, or who consults the dead. That's it.
But, I mean, the Bible also says, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, doesn't it? I mean, that's draconian, isn't it?
That's right. Well, yeah, but if you allow them to live, then you're going to allow witchcraft to proliferate.
It sounds a little bit draconian, because the law on witchcraft, I think, was changed at the end of the 1940s to say, well, it's actually fine now for people to do that here in Britain.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how things have gone, I'm afraid. Things have gone.
What do you think of the current, I mean, going back to Europe and now,
yes,
and Britain, is the extent and the kind of practices that modern witches get up to?
Well, I think I don't think people realise just how prevalent witchcraft is. I went to a meeting, what would it be? It would have been in the late 1980s, in a place called Broughton Astley in Leicestershire, and there was a woman speaking there. What was her name now? Dorothy somebody or other. Anyway, she was the head witch of Europe at that time. That's what she announced on the stage anyway. and she was saying that one of the things that they do in their witchcraft ceremonies is they burn Bibles. They have a big brazier on the stage with a sort of asbestos base so it doesn't burn up the stage. And they chuck Bibles into it. And she was saying that she was able to put her hands into the flames with the Bible in it, and the Bible would be burnt up, but her hands weren't touched, weren't damaged at all, because the demonic forces, it was a show of power for them, you see, to do that. Dorothy, sorry, can't remember. I should have had that at my fingertips, just can't remember. So witchcraft is very prevalent, and of course Satanism is extremely common now. In fact, there are several churches of Satan in this country, and in America, of course, there are quite a few, the main one being in San Francisco. I think it's called the Church of Satan.
Yeah, but I mean, we're living in an age now of religious tolerance where things like witchcraft are seen to be pretty benign, you know, yes, on the same level as maybe Judaism or Christianity.
Yeah, well, that's how things have gone, I'm afraid. That's how things have gone, and it'll get worse. We'll become more and more slack and more tolerant about all sorts of things. That's how the world is, I'm afraid. That's the way it's going.
And what's your prediction, finally, for the future then, Peter?
Well, I follow what the Bible says. A man is going to arise from Greece, a Greek, within the EU, who will become the Antichrist. He will broker a peace treaty with Israel, which will be for 7 years, and it will involve the EU armies and the countries of the Middle East. And under the terms of that treaty, the Jews will be allowed to rebuild their temple, the Solomon's Temple, in Jerusalem, and go about their business. But after 3.5 years, the Bible says, he will break the treaty. In other words, halfway through the seven-year period, he will break the treaty himself and take over. Of course, he'd have the armies there to keep charge of everything, keep control of everything under the terms of the treaty, but he will renege on the treaty and just take control. He's called in the Bible the Antichrist. And he will organize a system called the 666 system, where he will give everyone a number. Probably a microchip in the right hand.
Now, a lot of this stuff is there, certainly in the Bible, but do you think it's actually really ever going to happen?
Well, I mean, for instance, in America, they've got, and a lot of other places in the world, they've got a thing called the VeriChip. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. VeriChip, one word. You can look it up on the internet. People are having microchips implanted in their right hand, which is exactly what the Bible says. It'll be in the right hand. And it's a security system and a banking system and so on. You'll be able to have your right hand scanned, and the information on this thing will be picked up. And also another system, which is global, is the Mondex system, M-O-N-D-E-X, and that's also in the right hand. So, but that's all fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that as a security system. But of course, what's going to happen eventually is that this man is going to use that to take control. That's the problem. He'll use the numbering system to take control of people.
Well, one of the things that the Bible does say, doesn't it, in the book of Revelation, is something about you will not be able to buy or sell without
exactly,
the mark.
Exactly, yeah. That's what it says. That's Revelation chapter 13. Won't be able to buy or sell without the mark.
And the
mark will be a sign of allegiance to this man.
Now, I mean, much of what you say I'm very sceptical about, but one thing certainly does make me a little nervous is this whole contactless payment system we've got now, because we're really only one step away with contactless payment system that we've got now with credit cards, where you just sort of wave them near the
that's right, the
checkout. Now, we're only really one step away, aren't we, from having a microchip embedded in your hand, for example.
Indeed, absolutely.
Well, fascinating discussion, Peter.
Thanks ever so much.
And stay in touch.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Peter.
Yeah, God bless you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined on the line now by the Honourable, indeed, Paul T. Helier from Toronto in Canada. Hi, Paul, and welcome to Dialect.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you've come out with a book, which actually is one of those interesting books people might even be interested in for Christmas. It's called The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. Obviously, people don't really like thinking about the global financial crisis, but I suppose that's kind of hardwired in because the money masters, the people in control of money, really don't want people to understand, do they?
They don't want people to understand, that's for sure. That's the reason they've been able to get away with what I call grand larceny for decades, and to a lesser extent, even for centuries.
Okay, so what's so what's at the heart of this? We all know that we're having problems with massive amounts of debt. The debt is growing and growing. What's at the heart of it? How does it start? And also, I'm interested in where you think it's heading.
You can go way back in 300 years to the time when the Bank of England was chartered. And the king was short of money, so he decided to, and his credit was no good, so he got Parliament to pass this bill to incorporate the Bank of England. And rich people put in £1,200,000 in gold and silver, lent it all to the king at 8%, which is a pretty high interest rate for a guaranteed loan. And then to show his appreciation, he said, now you can print, P-R-I-N-T, £1,200,000, in banknotes and lend them to your rich friends at high interest rates. So in effect, they were allowed to lend the same money twice and collect interest from both the king and from their rich friends. Well, then over the years, this, what we call leverage, increased due to the greed of the banks and the cooperation of the politicians. And in the early years of the 20th century, federally chartered U.S. banks had to have a gold reserve of 25%, which meant the bankers were allowed to lend the same money four times. And in Canada, when I was young, the banks had to have a cash reserve of 8% rather, and so they were allowed to lend the same money 12.5 times. Well, then you come up to date, and the ideas of Milton Friedman and deregulated banks and a change in the system from cash reserves to capital adequacy. It was never capital adequacy. It was always capital inadequacy. But they were allowed to lend the same money 20 times. And this is, there is nothing equal to this in history as far as ripping people off is concerned and making life miserable for them. Now, the problem is that somehow governments, which own the patent to create money, have given their licensees, the banks, a monopoly. And we used to, in Canada at least, create some of our own money. We had the Bank of Canada creating money for the government from 1939 to 1974, and the system worked beautifully. That's what got us out of the Great Depression, because in 1938 there were no jobs in Canada, none. And along came the war, and within a very short period of time, everyone was working in the armed forces, and the unemployment rate came down to an historic low of 1%. We're not trying to emulate that today, but even 3 or 4 would be pretty good. And what was happening was that the Bank of Canada was printing, in effect, zero cost or near zero cost money for the government, which spent it into circulation. It's what the economists call high-powered money. And then the banks, it wound up in the banks where they used it as leverage to create their loans to help build factories and lend people for buying war bonds and so on. Well, this system worked beautifully. And it was in effect right through until 1974. So we were able to use it for building the St. Lawrence Seaway and Trans-Canada Highway and great new airport terminals, and to lay the foundation of our social security system, which was one of the best in the world at the time. And everything was going swimmingly until 1974, when they adopted the rules set by the Bank for International Settlements. And all of a sudden, the bank mafia, as I call them, took over the control of our system away from the central bank, which had been operating until then on behalf of its shareholders, or us, the people. And it's been downhill ever since.
Now, Paul, you also have some direct experience of government, don't you? Tell us about that.
Well, I was in the House of Commons for 23 and a half years, in three different administrations for 3 years. About 8 years. And I was Minister of National Defense in Canada for 6 years, and Minister of Transport and Housing for another couple of years. So I have a lot of experience, but most of all, I've seen how the system works, and I understand it. And I know that it is possible to use the monetary system to create full employment. And we don't have to have these massive, millions of people unemployed. It's just absolute nonsense. But that's what happens when you give licensees, because the banks have no rights at all. All they have are privileges that have been granted to them by parliaments. And what the privileges that were granted to them can be reduced, amended, or taken away. And what we have to do is to change the system and have the governments create part of the money. And in my book, I'm recommending 34% of all new money created should be by government, and it should be debt-free, spent into circulation, and that would be enough for governments to balance their budgets at all levels. You have a unitary state, so but in the United States and Canada, it would be enough to balance budgets at the federal and the state or provincial and the municipal levels, and leave some left over in the short run, at least, to reduce the existing debt. And it would just change the world, absolutely. And there are two objectives. One is to start using money, which is nothing but a computer entry, because it's not backed by anything except the credit of the country, but to use money for the benefit of the people, and not just for a handful of the richest, most ruthless, most uncaring people in the whole world, which is the present system. So that's one of the objectives. And the other objective is that the money mafia, and in conjunction with what I call the cabal, largely centered in the United States, but it spills over a little bit into Europe and elsewhere, the cabal has been running the world. It's been running the United States for 60 years. Instead of the President of the Congress being in charge, the cabal has been in charge. And they are strangling many economies for reasons which are not very good, not very nice. And if we had more time, I could go into explaining. But, as far back as 1941, before World War II was over, the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., was planning an empire that would be greater than the empire that the Germans were planning. And subsequently, they've taken on allies. The money mafia has been aligned, including the banking cartel, the oil cartel, multinational corporations, and in the U.S., at least, some of the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and a big slice of the armed forces. And what they have planned for us, as we find out when we start looking underneath the covers, is what they call a New World Order. Well, the New World Order is very much like the one that was being planned by the Germans in the 1930s. And it is not a democracy. It is an autocracy. You can use a stronger language, which I do sometimes. It's a dictatorship. That's what they're talking about. And some of them have gone so far as to admit that what they're trying to do is to have a world government that is run by bankers and the elite. Well, heaven help us if they can continue with this trajectory, the path that they're taking us on at the present time, because they're going to wind up, a few of them, very rich and powerful at the top of the dictatorship, and the rest of us are going to be nothing less than than debt slaves, which we're fast becoming anyway.
You mentioned there the Council on Foreign Relations. This is a not very well known about organisation, but it's very powerful, Paul, isn't it? Can you tell us who they are?
Well, it's a very powerful organisation. Actually, it's one of three that work together in this cabal that I was talking about. They are the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the oldest, and then the Bilderbergers, who came along later, and then the Trilateral Commission, which came along when Zbigniew Brzezinski realized that Japan was coming up in the world and that it would be a good idea to have Japan included in the relationship with America and Europe. And so these three work together, and there's a lot of cross-membership. But the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers are the two most important and the ones with the most clout. And of course, the Bilderbergers are the most secretive. But they have been planning this this new world order for a long time. And they're well advanced. And if we don't do something, we're going to wind up being nothing more than slaves.
Well, you say there, if we don't do something, but what can we do, Paul? I mean, you have been right in the seat of power in Canada. I'm also thinking, of course, about our governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. He was over at your central bank over in Canada too, and he was one of the key people who was running regulations for the banks at the Bank for International Settlements that you were talking about before.
He's a member of the club, and he was trained by Goldman Sachs. And he's one of the nicest guys you could possibly meet, but he's on the committee that is really determining our monetary future, and consequently, as far as I'm concerned, we have to change his mind along with a lot of others. But one of the advantages of the book is, Tony, is that I set out a whole range of solutions. I've never written a book yet where I talk about what's going wrong about something without them providing solutions.
Okay, well, can you sum your thoughts about the solutions up for us?
Well, just let me give you two or three, because there are a lot. But the most urgent one is for government-created debt-free money to be infused into the system, to get it back up to speed, so that poverty and unemployment cannot be used as an excuse for getting people to accept martial law if someone tried to impose it. That is the most urgent. And in the book, I have a formula which some of my colleagues and I worked out and presented to the Canadian government a couple of years ago. And it would do the job of reducing bank leverage from 20 to 1, which is a monopoly, to 2 to 1 in 7 years. And at the same time, without disrupting the system, it would keep going, and the banking industry is a big industry. There are a lot of people employed, so the people would not be thrown out of their jobs. They would still have jobs, except for some of the maybe the traders and the top insiders who have been making such fantastic amounts of money for doing things that are of really no use, but making money for the bankers and their affiliates. So that's the most urgent. Well, then the other thing that happens when you do that and take control, you're really breaking the control of the cabal once they have lost the control of the money system. That is the apex of their power. And as long as they control the money supply worldwide, they can set the amount of growth and the amount of unemployment for any country, which they do, and they're ruthless. And, you know, they're the ones that provide the trouble for the European countries who gave up their rights when the euro was introduced. And so there's a special thing that has to be done there, and that is that the European Central Bank has to start accepting, and this is the mechanism that I've proposed in the book, start accepting shares in the country, just non-convertible, non-redeemable shares in the country as collateral to create money for them, to spend into circulation and to meet their needs. And this would be instead of bonds, which they have to redeem and pay interest on. And there's no reason in the world why that can't be done, because, as I say, we the people own the patent. It is ours to use. Our problem is that our politicians have sold out and are not using the power, which is ours, for our benefit. So we have to really go at the politicians. And it's a big fight because the cabals, the money cartel have the money, but we have the numbers. And if we could just get mobilized enough numbers, and in the States I'm saying, you know, all of the decent people and all of the war veterans of all wars and all of the young people who are so idealistic and whose futures are really on the line. Because in Canada, we're just fast losing a whole generation of young people who don't have the kind of opportunity that I had and my generation had. And if we don't do something really fast, you know, life is going to pass them by. And it will be just like the 1930s all over again. And it does not need to be. Well, then, of course, the next thing is the biggest problem in the world is global warming. And what if you change the money system, then you can have the financial flexibility to change from a fossil fuel economy to a clean energy economy. So the technology is there to save the world, but the politicians, at least in my part of the world, are talking about building pipelines and drilling wells sort of on the basis of 20, 30, 40, 50 years payout. And this is absolute insanity.
Yeah, there's all sorts of other forms of energy. We don't need to be using so much fossil fuels, and also using much less energy. But Paul, ultimately, you talk about a fight there. The cabal, the Bilderbergs, the Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, these powerful business groups that now have a big involvement in funding political parties, funding politicians, paying their bills as well. Is there any real chance, you think, that ordinary people will get a money system which actually does the job of a utility, that is, just to sort of facilitate trade rather than as a use of control?
That's what we have to do. If we don't do it, we're sunk. It's as simple as that. And we have to start right away. Because coming back to the global warming, for example, I'm saying we should... Well, first of all, let me go back... 3 or 4 years ago, I wrote a book called Light at the End of the Tunnel, which I thought was going to be my last one. And in it, I said we had 10 years to convert from one system to the other. And now, 3 years later, I say we have 7 years. And in that 7 years, we should convert every car, truck, tractor, airplane, and house in the world from fossil fuels to clean energy. And the technology exists, and if we change the money system, the money would exist. But now we'd have to get the technology pried out of the cabal, and probably what we'd have to do is to get President Obama to do something heroic in his last 2 years and issue a presidential order that would make the technology available to the whole world without, you know, big royalties, and make it universally available so that every country could build their own and put their own people back to work. And I people say, well, you can't move that fast. Well, I say you can, because I saw it in World War II. In World War II, we took every automobile company and every refrigerator manufacturer and every stove manufacturer and converted them into making armaments.
Paul, the people that now control our money system, the banksters, I call them, are not going to give up easily, are they? At the moment, that they have a tremendous amount of power, and as we know, people don't like to give that sort of power up. So how do you see the next few years playing out?
Well, I can't talk in the terms of the next few years because that's too late. We have to wrest control of it now, N-O-W, and I mean presumably in 2015. And we have to start. All we have to do to start is to get the governments to accept their responsibility, get the G20 to listen to reason and stop acting as nothing but a photo op group of 20 and propping up the old derelict banking system, which is all they've done since they met in Toronto a few years ago, and get the people so worked up, realizing that they're not only their jobs and their welfare, but their future, literally, maybe the future of the human species, literally, are at stake. And something has got to happen. It has to happen right away. You know, I'm not talking about 10 years or 5 years down the pike. I'm talking about 2015, people really starting to do something and taking the politicians on for size. And the one way that you can get politicians' attentions is to let them know that if they don't do what you tell them, and I've a nice list that we can post, and much of it is already in my book, The Money Mafia, if they don't do these things right away, they're going to be toast in the next general election.
That was Paul T. Hellyer speaking to me from Toronto, Canada. He's a politician, journalist and commentator, Canada's senior privy councillor, rather close to the Queen, best known for the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces and for his 1968 chairmanship of the Canadian Task Force on Housing and Urban Development, when things like that used to matter. His book, The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis, is available online and is priced at £14. You can get it second-hand or new from online book services around about £7. Again, the book's title, The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And for those of you listening on the podcast, in fact, you can get that from Radio 4 All, number 4, all.net. Or at dialectradio.co.uk. Here's Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 19th of December, Michael Schenker's Temple of Rock will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £23.50 each and doors open at 6:30 pm. Also on 19th of December, Snatch 22 will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Joe Strummer. In a career that spanned over 30 years, he performed with the 101ers, co-founded the British punk group The Clash, performed solo work, and also formed Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros. On December 22nd, 2002, the music world lost one of the iconic figures of the British punk movement when Joe Strummer passed away at age 50. Here is the track Coma Girl from the album Streetcore by Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros, which was released after Joe Strummer's death.
I was crawling through a festival way out west. I was thinking about love and the acid test. At first I got real dizzy with a real rocking gang. And then I saw the Coma Girl on the excitement. 19th hour was falling upon Desolation Row. So my love band at the last drop on the gold. Let's siphon up some gas, let's get this show on the road. Said the coma girl to the excitement gang. Into action, everybody sprang. And the old drums were beating out, Tulang, Tulang. Coma girl of the excitement gang. On a motorcycle gang.
Girl from the album Streetcore. Into Sunday 21st of December, Bad Manners will be performing with special guests at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Monday 22nd of December, remembering and celebrating Joe Strummer with the Clash tribute to Radio Clash and also a DJ set from Gaz La Punk at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all for me. Thanks for listening and have a good Christmas and New Year. Take care and goodbye.
That's all for this week. And that's all for 2014. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly podcast broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, that's Peter Campbell Barker, and also the Honourable Paul Hellier, former Canadian Defence Minister, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good Christmas break. Thanks for listening. Till the first week in January, goodbye for now.
To say, live and let live.
You know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die.
Let die.
used to say, live and let live. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.